The following is an encore presentation of Conversations on Healthcare.
The important topics of reproduction and maternal health are in the policy portfolio of Carol Johnson. She's the administrator of the Health Resources and Service Administration, known as HRSA, which is an important agency at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
The bigger picture here is about how we as a nation want to move forward in protecting women's rights and protecting the autonomy of women's reproductive freedom, and in ensuring that we are growing and developing a healthcare workforce that can support women's healthcare needs. And that's what we want to do in this administration, is continue to grow that healthcare workforce, continue to make sure the training opportunities are available to provide the kind of healthcare support that women need across the country.
With a multi-billion dollar budget, HRSA reaches every part of the country, including Alabama, where families seeking IVF treatment are reeling from that state's controversial court ruling.
It's really important that women have the autonomy and the ability to make informed healthcare decisions with their healthcare providers. And so that's why the secretary was in Alabama this week. That is why we as an administration are going to do everything we can to ensure that we sustain and maintain and grow the autonomy that women have to ensure that their reproductive rights are protected and that they have the ability to make the best choices possible. It should not be the case that young women in this generation have less rights than I did growing up.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Administrator Carol Johnson, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we want to start with the Alabama Supreme Court decision that frozen embryos are children, and there's a lot of legislative maneuvering going on right now. The Alabama House just passed a bill to protect providers who engage, and I believe hospitals, in vitro fertilization, give them immunity. But on February 28th, a Republican U.S. senator blocked a similar effort in that chamber. Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith of Mississippi said the bill is a vast, and I quote, overreach. We wanted to get your reaction to the entire situation down in Alabama.
Yeah, well, thank you for raising the question, and thank you for putting the focus on the families who are now in very difficult position of trying to figure out their next steps, trying to ensure that they have confidence in their family choices. Again, this is about how families plan and make family choices. And that should be something that women and their doctors are able to do together. We say that across the board. It's really important that women have the autonomy and the ability to make informed healthcare decisions with their healthcare providers. And so that's why the secretary was in Alabama this week. That is why we as an administration are going to do everything we can to ensure that we sustain and maintain and grow the autonomy that women have to ensure that their reproductive rights are protected and that they have the ability to make the best choices possible. It should not be the case that young women in this generation have less rights than I did growing up. And we need to change that. And so the other thing that I will point out, as you note, we at HRSA focus on the health and well-being of moms and babies through our maternal and child health work. But we are also the home of the healthcare workforce investments across the Department of Health and Human Services. And we continue to see challenges in making sure that people who go into healthcare professions are going to go to states where there are restrictive environments about the ways that physicians can practice medicine. And so we need to make sure that we're not only protecting and wrapping ourselves around families and helping women ensure that they have their reproductive health rights, but also that we're supporting a workforce that can ensure that those opportunities are available to families in states where there's a more restrictive legislative environment.
Well, Administrator Johnson, I really appreciate those comments. And maybe just clarify for me a little bit, what can the federal government do to aid families who are in limbo at this time or questioning what to do. I understand that moving embryos out of the state is not an option. Is that all within the control of the state? Just help us figure out what the federal government can do in this situation to help.
I think there are a lot of things that are within the jurisdiction of states and a lot of things that states will make decisions about. As you noted, there are legislators in the state who are taking action in the short term here. But the bigger picture here is about how we as a nation want to move forward in protecting women's rights and protecting the autonomy of women's reproductive freedom and in ensuring that we are growing and developing a healthcare workforce that can support women's healthcare needs. And that's what we want to do in this administration is continue to grow that healthcare workforce, continue to make sure that training opportunities are available to provide the kind of healthcare support that women need across the country. And so, you know, the secretary was there in Alabama earlier this week. And as part of that said, he would continue to come back and work with all of us across HHS on where there are opportunities that we can be helpful and supportive. But at the same time, we will continue to lean in as an administration in supporting women.
And it's so important, as you mentioned earlier, trying to figure out where are places that people can go and feel safe. 2% of live births result from IVF. It's a large number across the country. Where else is the administration focused in on in terms of states? As you think about where a workforce should go, are there other states like Alabama that are considering these changes to their constitution?
I don't know that I can speak to what decisions are being made in other states or what is on deck in other states. I can speak to what we as an administration will continue to lean into, which is being having the backs of women and families across our country.
Well, Administrator Johnson, one area that has been a loud and clear focus of the administration is the recognition of the rising rates of maternal mortality and morbidity and the need to do something about it and to act. HRSA has invested $65 million in community health centers just last year to improve maternal health care access, launched a maternal mental health hotline, has special grants to try innovations in maternity care. Share with us those efforts and what are we seeing on the ground that is innovative? Is it too early to see results? Tell us about that.
Yeah, thanks, Margaret, for the question. Look, you know, starting at the beginning of this administration, the president and the vice president said it is absolutely unacceptable that the United States has the maternal mortality rate that we have. That is not something that this administration can abide, and that we need to pull every possible lever to improve maternal health outcomes for women. And what it turns out is that 80% of maternal deaths are preventable. And they're preventable because they are caused by things like mental health conditions, cardiovascular conditions, social determinants of health that we know is an area of considerable need of attention, not just what happens inside the clinic walls, but what happens in the community. And that's why across the administration, we have made this a priority. I got to participate in the first ever cabinet meeting focused on women's health and maternal mortality, where the vice president pulled us all together and said, this is not just a healthcare issue. It is critically a healthcare issue, but not just a healthcare issue. This is about the Department of Labor, and the Secretary of Labor was there. This is about what happens at the Department of Agriculture when it comes to food and nutrition services. It's about transportation and the VA. And I sat next to the Secretary of Housing. It is about making sure that we're doing a whole of government response here. Our part at HRSA is, as you mentioned, really focusing on how we pull levers across all of our funding streams. So we're not just putting more money into health centers, we're putting more money into training more midwives. We're putting more money into training more community-based doulas who reflect the communities they serve and can be a voice for women who are often not heard in the delivery environment and who know something is wrong, but don't get the response that they need because the system isn't structured around them. And too often what we hear from women is, I did everything right and I still had a bad outcome. That is a failure of all of us as a nation. It shouldn't be on the woman to say, all of this is on you. It should be us making sure that we've done everything possible for them. That's why we're investing in making sure that hospitals are prepared for the most common causes of maternal crises in delivery, like hemorrhage. That's why we're investing in social determinants of health. So we support the Healthy Start program to make sure there are community supports that can help ensure people get to prenatal visits and postnatal visits. Mm-hmm. And that's why this administration is so proud to say that nearly every state has extended Medicaid to 12 months postpartum.
I want to take a little look at your own data, which shows that maternal mortality and other adverse outcomes associated with pregnancy or childbirth have worsened. The rate in 2021 was 89% higher than in 2018. The maternal mortality rate among non-Hispanic Black and African-American women was about 2.5 times greater than non-Hispanic white women during these years. And I'm wondering if you could just focus in on what the role COVID played in these disparities.
Yeah, well, obviously, COVID played a considerable part in health outcomes across all of our metrics. I would also say there's some time lag in that data, but nonetheless, COVID had a big impact, not just on maternal health, which is a critical priority for us, but on other critical healthcare needs. Like, again, we are the home of the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. We care a great deal about children, ensuring that they're up to date on their vaccines. Places like making sure that routine vaccines are delivered, places like oral health in children. That oral health was one of the areas where the rebound post-COVID was the slowest. And so we're focused on making sure kids are getting their oral health care. But when it comes to maternal mortality, you know, we think that there were obviously issues and challenges during COVID. We saw a lot of states try to do things like make sure doulas were allowable in hospitals during delivery. There was so much restricted access during delivery, but yet we had this known way to help improve healthcare outcomes, and they weren't always allowed in the delivery room. So all the kinds of things that are lessons learned from COVID are the kinds of things we're working strategically to improve and grow going forward.
Well, Administrator, you've focused on recommendations that have gone back many years now, and you're putting them all into place, which is really fantastic in a short period of time. I want to focus maybe just on the health workforce for a moment. We talked about it earlier with regard to the Alabama situation, but obviously making sure that there are enough nurses, labor delivery nurses, nurse midwives, women's health nurse practitioners, OBGYNs in underserved areas as critical. I think for our audience, maybe share some of the strategies that HRSA has to really bring these critical personnel through training and get them to the areas where they're most needed. And I'll add community health workers and health support workers of all kinds to the list. Tell us about the strategies for making this happen.
Well, thanks for the question, and thank you for your thought leadership on this, Margaret. You have been a real leader in thinking about how to build a community-based health workforce. And that is very much what we are focused on at HRSA. How do we ensure that we're training people? We incentivize the creation of training placements in the community where we want people to practice. That's how we're more likely to get clinicians who reflect the communities that they serve. That's how we're more likely to build a workforce that will stay in those communities. And so we have a number of strategies to do this, not least of which is our National Health Service Corps program, which is where we provide scholarships and loan repayment to primary care clinicians to practice in the highest need areas in the country, including many urban areas and many rural areas across this country who would not have primary care providers but for the National Health Service Corps. I will tell you, thanks to the president, we've had the largest investment in the National Health Service Corps in the 50-year history of the program under this administration. But that program expired at the end of September, and Congress has not yet reauthorized it and provided the funding necessary for us to continue it. So we are very anxious for this bipartisan, well-supported program to actually get the resources we need so that we can continue and to sustain and grow this strategy for building a workforce in the community. Similarly, we are investing in training nurses, including advanced practice nurses, who are primary care providers in so many places across the country, and support investing in mobile clinics so that nurse practitioners can get into the community and deliver critical primary primary care services all across the board, everywhere we can. We are thinking strategically about how, A, do we get a young person interested in the healthcare field? How do we support them through health professions training with mentoring and other supports? How do we help them with stipends and tuition support and the like get through training? How do we encourage them with loan repayment to go to the communities where we need them the most? And so that continuum is critically important to us, and we're investing all along the way.
Well, that investment in training is so important. You're also engaged in cultivating collaboration and partnership. And I note that HRSA has maternal health grantees from 11 states in the District of Columbia in this initiative. I'm wondering how you chose those states. And talk to us a little bit of how you anticipate them learning from each other. That collaborative relationship is so important. And I know that's one of HRSA's goals.
Thanks so much for raising it. We last month launched what we're calling our Enhancing Maternal Health Initiative. And what we are saying here is look, we know there's a lot of debate in Congress and we're not done on all the appropriations bills and we don't know what our budget's going to look like this year. But we have a lot of investments and a lot of work and support and grantees that we've built up in communities across the country. So let's look at those places where we have a lot of HRSA resources that have been invested and where the maternal mortality rates are higher than we'd like them to be. And how do we ensure that all of those grantees are working together in a way that ensures that the whole is better than the sum of the parts? Mm-hmm. And so how do we leverage to make sure that the nurse midwives we're training are available to and know and can train in our health centers where we're investing in maternal health work? How do we make sure everyone in our AIM program, where we're focused on what happens in the hospital, that relationship with the hospital is also translated into everyone leaving that hospital having our maternal mental health hotline number so that we can treat and intervene in maternal depression as early as possible? Our maternal mental health hotline number is 833-TLC-MAMA. That's our 24/7 text and call way for people to get emotional and mental health support. And we are finding that pregnant women, new moms, other family members of new moms are calling and getting that kind of emotional and mental health support and referral when necessary. So we're thinking about how do we strategically put all of HRSA's grantees together around a table and get the best possible outcome from that collaboration rather than continuing to fund multiple different grantees doing important work, but not interconnected work.
Margaret, well, I love that. TLC Mama sounds great.
Absolutely. And, you know, Administrator, we're talking about maternal mortality, but I want to talk just for a moment about infant mortality and note that HRSA has reported that the infant mortality rate overall, though we still see some disparities between groups, overall continues to decline and reach even historic lows, which is just wonderful news. You know, in the past years, you and people in the community have been promoting messages about taking folic acid supplements, not smoking, getting early prenatal care. What do you think we can learn from these infant mortality campaigns that can inform maternal mortality? Are they kind of mirror images, or is there something really different about the two groups in terms of our messaging?
It's such a great question. Thanks for the question, Margaret. I think we would, as you did, like it's very important to note that the disparities still exist in the infant mortality space as well. And we obviously have more work to do. But I think you're right that what we've seen here is in infant mortality is really a marriage of well thought out public health interventions coupled with clinical interventions, coupled with community interventions. Like unless we're thinking about it in that sort of holistic way, we aren't going to make meaningful progress. And so lots of investment in community prevention campaigns and community education campaigns, lots of investment in insurance coverage and in making sure that kids are covered. And, you know, that was that like CHIP predates our work in the Affordable Care Act. We knew that kids had to have coverage, and then making sure that we're thinking about early access to food, early access to school lunch, early access to all the things, SNAP expansion, all the things that make it possible for families to thrive. And so there is much to learn there, I think. And I think one of the critical things that we focus on is it's been an incredible success to get so many people covered, both through our Medicaid expansion and the numbers of folks who took up Affordable Care Act coverage this year. But your insurance card needs to get you to a high quality place to get care. And that's why investments in places like community health centers, in our rural partners, in the ways that we're trying to build those footprints around the country where primary care is well supported, well funded, and we're recruiting the workforce to deliver that care is so important.
Administrator, the U.S. Government Accountability Office recommended some improvements in how HHS measures its performance regarding maternal health, and HHS agreed to these changes. Can you fill our audiences in on the role and value of such performance measures?
We think performance measures are really important, right? Like, it's absolutely critical that we are holding ourselves accountable. These are taxpayer dollars. We are stewards of, and there's a sacred trust with the community that you invest in the work we're doing, and then we're going to tell you how well it's going. The one thing I would say that's really important to note, though, is that we also want to make sure that new innovation and community strategies are part of the equation too. Too often we hear from initiatives that have worked on the ground in communities that are sensitive to communities' needs and responsive to the community, that they haven't had the resources and capacity to do a study that documents the evidence to prove that X, Y, or Z happened. But it is clearly making a difference in the community. And we need to, as we focus on performance measures and accountability, also account for things that are evidence-informed and places where community interventions are making a meaningful difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, Administrator, members of the Black Maternal Health Caucus have highlighted the very important role of HRSA in their goal to pass the Momnibus Act. That's a great name for a new piece of legislation. What would this legislation do?
Yeah, so I actually had the opportunity to, as part of the kickoff of our Enhancing Maternal Health event initiative last month, we started that initiative by first hearing from the voices of women who have had adverse maternal health outcomes or otherwise had experienced in the clinical system where their voices weren't heard and their pregnancies were more complicated as a consequence. But then I had the chance to at that event, have a dialogue with Congresswoman Lauren Underwood, who is the co-chair of the Congressional Maternal Mortality Caucus, and who is working on these issues directly, who spoke eloquently about how important investments in HRSA have been to helping to advance the overall goals of the caucus. And that is, things like the work we do in Healthy Start, where dollars are going directly to community-based organizations, where, I had the chance recently to visit one of our Healthy Start grantees with the secretary, where women talked about how the Healthy Start grantee was their support during pregnancy, was the way that they got ensured that someone was following up with them, helping them figure out how to prepare, what was next. And then once they had their children, being able to get on a pathway to ensuring that they had tenancy preparedness so that they could get an apartment, ensuring that they could get into community college. I mean, that is the way we need to think about these interventions and the way that we're excited about doing more of going forward.
I think all Americans would hope that COVID was in our rear view mirror, but it's still with us quite prevalent. And you had a catbird seat because you previously served on President Biden's White House COVID-19 response team. And your area of focus was testing. Just want to ask you to address, how do you think HRSA's handled this year's COVID season? And what will you be doing differently when the vaccine campaign starts up in the fall?
Yeah, and it is really amazing. But in my prior seat on the president's COVID response team, how often we turned to HRSA to be able to make sure that there was equitable access to services. And so, as I like to say, I know more about which health centers in America have a loading dock versus not, because we delivered pallets of tests and masks and all kinds of things directly to health centers, so that, and then they did the incredible work of packaging it up, wrapping it up with fact sheets in the language of the community, and getting it out to people with through their community health workers, through those kind of interventions. And health centers delivered more than 20 million doses of the vaccine. You know, it is amazing what health centers and rural health clinics, first time we were ever able to give direct funding to rural health clinics, really being able to think about, where are trusted people in the community? Who are they? How do we get these resources to those folks? Because that's who people are going to turn to. And we see that again and again. And we see that now in this RSV season, as we tend to call it, right? Because there's a lot of stuff out there right now. And we know that that's going to be important going forward. It's really important for particularly for older adults who we interact with, through who we deliver care through, either through health centers or rural clinics, or even in our HIV work, making sure that we leverage all those touch points to get people up to date on vaccines.
You know, let me just follow up on that around the financing, the funds that are available. We're at this inflection point in Washington where a budget hasn't been passed. Tell us about what the budget looks like for HRSA, hope for, and also maybe how this will flow down. What's the larger picture look like now as we still have no completed resolution on the budget?
Yeah, you know, we're at a critical inflection point at HRSA. We fund 1,500 community health centers across the country that see 30 million people, regardless of ability to pay. They're the go-to source for healthcare in communities all across this country. We fund more than 20,000 people in the National Health Service Corps who are getting scholarships and loan repayment to practice in those high-need communities. We fund teaching health centers that are training new providers in those communities. All of those programs have expired. They have to get funded in this new package. They have to be part of the deal in order for us to continue, just to continue keeping the lights on and doing the work we're doing. But the president said in our budget, we actually should be doubling the investment in health centers. They're a proven model that works. We know people need access to primary care, and this is a way to do it. So we have seen some fits and starts on that effort, but we're going to keep at it and lean into what we need to do to continue to grow those investments, so that people can get primary health care that is sensitive to their culture, that is responsive to their needs, and that is a place where we can do all the things that are really priorities in this administration. You know, my goal, our goal, president's goal, is to get mental health and substance use disorder services mm-hmm. delivered in community health centers. You know, the reality is we're in a moment where everyone in America now understands how critically important it is to have mental health and substance use disorder treatment services readily available. And we have made incredible investments in this administration in across the board in growing the footprint of those services. But if we're not leveraging primary care to help expand access to mental health and substance use disorder, then we're missing a huge opportunity, both because there is so much that can be done there, but also because that's a trusted provider that people are willing to talk to about their behavioral health needs. And if we're not ready to respond, then we're missing an opportunity. So I firmly believe that behavioral health has to be part of primary care. And whenever someone raises their hand, we have to be there to be able to meet those needs.
Well, Administrator Carol Johnson, thank you for joining us. Thanks to our audience for being here. Be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc.